I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. What makes cities successful? It's a question we ask every week here on Smart City. Today we have two authorities from the University of Chicago to address the topic, one with a very local view and the other with a global outlook. Sean Safford has studied the decline of Rust Belt cities and found that particular kinds of social networks were key to a city's ability to renew. Saskia Sassen has studied global cities and concluded that corporate headquarters are less important to a city than our globe-trotting consultants. We'll talk to Sean Safford and Saskia Sassen today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Sean Safford is Assistant Professor of Organizations and Strategy at the University of Chicago. His research interests include social, economic, and technological change, particularly in mature industrial economies, and historical social network analysis. He was a lecturer at the London School of Economics and a postdoctoral fellow MIT Industrial Performance Center and MIT Cambridge Institute in 2004. His publications include Why the Garden Club Couldn't Save Youngstown. So, Sean, why couldn't the Garden Club save Youngstown?
Let me just tell you kind of really quickly how I came up with that title. I mean, the way I did the research for my dissertation was I was traveling to Allentown and Youngstown every few weeks. I would sit through the archives and I would look at the boards of directors of all of these civic organizations, including the hospitals and the symphony and the arts. And I was just sitting there looking at the one for the garden club in Youngstown. And I was realizing this was a place that people were really doing everything you should do when you think about Robert Putnam and the idea of social capital, the idea of people really showing up and participating. And this was happening in Youngstown. And yet the place really fell apart in the 70s and 80s. And the reason why I realized was because those people were not just kind of there actively participating in the civic world. They were connected up to the economic world, right? In a sense, they weren't any different. There was no difference between the civic world and the economic world in Youngstown. So when the economic world collapsed, it brought those people who had been involved in the civic world with it, right? And so when that collapse happened, when Youngstown's economy fell apart, it didn't have a basis. There was no platform left for anyone in that city to get together and cooperate to figure out what to do to bring that city back.
I think in some ways your work is really counterintuitive because many people say, well, what this town needs is leadership. We need one voice, one vision. In fact, that was actually the slogan of Louisville, Jefferson County when they consolidated. And yet, you say that having the civic structure and the economic structure of a town in distress completely overlapping turned out to be a very bad thing. Explain why it was a bad thing.
Well, again, it just gets back to this idea that when you have a place where everyone knows everyone else and where the same people are on all those same boards, right, you get two things happen. First, it's insular. Right? Everything I know, you know, right? If I see you all the time, if we're all on the same boards, we're just reinforcing sort of what we already think we know, and we're not learning anything new. So that's one problem. But then the second problem is without the kind of diversity, without the linkages across and between and within, the kind of fabric-like looking social structure of a place, without that kind of structure, what happens is you just get this big clump, and when that clump goes away, it brings everything down with it. It's a house of cards. However, when you have these overlapping networks, when you have pockets of people who are connected up in a much richer way, it's more resilient. When one part of it falls apart, it doesn't drag the rest of the structure with it.
Tell me why you were studying Youngstown and Allentown.
I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and I was in grad school, and I was looking for a project, and I sat down one day, and this happened to have been the time when Hillary Clinton was running for Senate, and she was thinking about upstate New York and its economic issues, and so was I, having grown up there, and I wanted to write something that I thought this would be useful. I heard so many things about what to do about the Rust Belt, and I thought, you know, I think I can say something different. But I wanted to say it in a really powerful way, in a way that I thought both I would get some insight and I could actually say something that I felt like I could prove. So I'd been a labor history major in college. I'd worked in the labor movement for a while, and I knew quite a bit about the steel industry and what had happened to it. But that's not how I came to them. I did a statistical study where I essentially tried to predict, given what we knew about a community in the 70s, and I selected, I don't know, 30 to 50, I forget, similar-looking communities, and I put all the statistics that we could think of to try to predict where they should be in 2000. And when you do that, you get sort of a scatter. And I figured out who was well above where we thought they should be and who was well below. And I just kind of eyeballed it from there. What I noticed was Allentown and Youngstown. Allentown was doing well and Youngstown wasn't. And that they had very similar histories and backgrounds. And I thought, this is something I can really make hay out of and try to really dig my heels into and really understand.
And what was it about Allentown that made it outperform the predictions?
I think what's happened there that I think is worth other places paying attention to is that they've succeeded not by either trying to prop up what they had, that there was no way they were going to save Bethlehem Steel in the end. Mack Truck, another major employer, has gone through huge transitions, and certainly people wanted to keep them from dying, and they've done everything they could to make that happen, and that's been fine. But they haven't staked their future on it, and at the same time, they haven't staked their future on trying to find or attract employers from the outside to sort of save the day. Instead, what they've figured out how to do, or what's happened, is that if you think about this as a sort of a tiered social structure, maybe a hub-and-spoke structure, with those big, big employers that we all know the names of at the center, and then all of the other smaller people sort of trailing behind or connected to them in sort of a hub-and-spoke way, what's happened is that those secondary companies, the organizations on the second tier of that structure, are the ones that have been able to transform themselves and become sort of important actors on the global stage. What's not happened in some other communities is that those people, the people kind of left behind in the dust, the rubble of the Rust Belt falling apart, they haven't been able to make that transition, and that's really, I think, what explains whether one place makes it and one place doesn't.
Why were the businesses in that second tier or in those spokes, how were they able to make the transition?
The basic premise that I start from when I think about what's happened to mature industrial regions in the U.S. and around the world is we had an economic structure which was, we talk about it all the time, but it was based on these large manufacturing companies. And then what you had were all these smaller companies that fed into those manufacturing companies. So what you had in a region like Allentown or Youngstown wasn't just a couple of big companies, Bethlehem Steel, Youngstown Sheet and Tube, Republic Steel, but you had those companies plus all of their suppliers, which were local. What they've faced now is that as globalization has proceeded, those big companies have figured out ways to tap into global marketplaces, and partly they've done it by severing their relationships to these local suppliers. And what has faced small and medium-sized companies in these mature cities is how to survive in the face of that. It's not only global competition, it's how to survive in the face of a much harsher world in which they need to play in global commodity chains. I mean, that's the challenge, is how you get them to do that. And the reason that I think companies in Allentown, and I could point to a couple of spectacular examples like PP&L, which is the local utility, which has become a global energy conglomerate. There was a subsidiary of Lucent Technology or Bell Labs that spun off and became a high-tech manufacturer in its own right, headquartered in Allentown. And then there have just been a whole slew of kind of smaller entrepreneurial companies or companies that were at one time small manufacturers that have picked up design capabilities and moved forward that underlay, that have become the foundation of what Allentown's economy is today. And what made that possible in part was a social structure in the community, in Allentown itself, that really was able to come together around a few simple but good ideas and cooperate. But also out of that process, just the process of cooperating, that community got kind of re-stitched together in a new way, in a way that is much more conducive. And it allows companies not only to do very concrete things like get financing, deal with their labor unions in effective and a cooperative way, but also just kind of produces this more generalized spirit that this is a place where things can get done. And, you know, the opposite really results, and it resulted in Youngstown, where not only were companies not able to do just the simple things like get financing, and certainly labor relations was very problematic in that city, but again, there was just a generalized sense of pessimism, and all of these things combined to create this kind of divergent pattern that I saw.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Sean Safford. He is Assistant Professor of Organizations and Strategy at the University of Chicago. You talk about a social structure in Allentown that came together around a few ideas. What if those ideas had been wrong or wrong-headed?
There have been just hundreds of ideas over this period of time, and I don't think Allentown or Youngstown was different in being exposed to any of those ideas. There was industrial policy in the early 80s, and there have been training programs and cluster theory and just all of these approaches to what to do. And I think those ideas have just washed over these places. What I think differentiates a place, certainly if they've focused in on one and it had been a bad idea, and I think lots of places have, I think one thing Youngstown did was to really try to attract another big manufacturer to kind of replace what had been there. And I think in the end that's a bad strategy for any place, and they did sort of hone in on it. But even that strategy in Youngstown, let's say, the social structure made it such that they couldn't really follow through on it. So even if it was a bad strategy, they couldn't follow through. And the good strategies, they couldn't really get going. Now, in Allentown, I think some good strategies floated to the surface, and the not-so-good ones floated away. But even in a place like Allentown, there's something about the place that makes it possible to follow through. I would predict, I suppose, they would have moved on to a better one. Maybe that's exactly what happened. I just couldn't see it with the historical lens.
You criticize Youngstown for attempting to attract a big replacement manufacturer, but you've just described the economic development strategy of half the cities in America. So, So why is it, Sean, that cities continue to hang on to this notion of attract the right big company and give them lots of tax incentives to move here, and that will save us?
You'd have to ask them. I mean, I can certainly see personally why it's an attractive thing to do. It seems like such an intractable problem. You have a large workforce of people who are comfortable and who are skilled, but they're skilled in things that have diminishing value in some ways. And so what you want to do is to find the few remaining providers of jobs like that and attract them. I mean, the thing that happens is it's just not sustainable, and we've seen that. I mean, at least the two problems. First, you know, it's not only just competition from China or the Maquiladora region of Mexico that is attracting that kind of manufacturing. It's the fact that one suburb is competing against the one next door to give them even bigger tax breaks and things like that. And it just undermines not only the economic fabric, but it really actually undermines the social fabric. It turns this into a competition within a region, and it undercuts, I think, what's possible for a region to achieve just because there's so much infighting around it. So why they do it, I don't know, but I can say I think fairly confidently that I think it's not the right strategy.
Can a city set out to create the kinds of social networks that work in favor of Allentown deliberately? In other words, can you say, that's our goal, and we want to set up this kind of social network that is not insular, that's not completely overlapping? Can you do that?
Certainly, the way it played out in my research, these things happen really for historical reasons. And I think the answer to that is a combination of two things. I don't think you can set out to engineer from scratch, in a sense, or let me put it this way, there's no such thing as scratch, right? You have to work with what you've got. Mm. And what you've got is going to determine a lot of things. But now that said, I think the real problem is that there are tools out there for understanding what a social network looks like. And I think the tools are actually fairly simple. You go out and you figure out a dimension on which you want to look at connections among people, and you gather the data, and, you know, there's software now out there. Well, lots of people are familiar with Friendster. There are ways of analyzing that data that are out there. I think the problem is not necessarily lack of a way to move forward. It's the fact that most people don't really think about it in these terms, that this is something I can actually put on a piece of paper and understand. So I think history has a big part to play in this, but if we actually put it on a piece of paper and understand what the social structure looks like and look for those holes, what some people refer to as a structural hole, right? Not the connections, but the disconnections, then it becomes much more possible to start thinking about, well, all right, this is clearly a place where we need to connect up some parts of the social structure that aren't connected, and what can we do about it? And I think you can start coming up with some localized strategies for moving forward.
You've looked at the role that universities can play in making a city resilient. Talk about that for a minute. What did you find?
You know, I started this essentially from I guess I mentioned I grew up in Buffalo, and Buffalo was hurting at the time, and Bethlehem Steel Plant in Lackawanna was shutting down, and the city was really worried about its future. And this was the early 80s, and one of the shining beacons that was kind of left in that city, and still is the University of Buffalo. And it was just almost natural for people to say, this is a place where we can start doing something positive. And so just like every other town I can think of that has a decent university in a mature industrial area, they started looking at the university to say, okay, what can you do? How can you get more involved in what's happening in our community? How can we leverage you to create a knowledge economy, et cetera? And I think universities were just really thrown into that and didn't quite know what to do with it. And in fact, there's just a huge variety of things that universities have tried to do. And so part of what I've done is try to look at, well, given the mandate of please help this struggling community move forward, what did universities do and what's really worked? I very simplistically boil this down to sort of two main approaches. One was to turn the university into sort of a factory, saying, okay, there are smart people here who are coming up with good ideas, and if one of those good ideas catches, it could turn into the next Cisco or Microsoft or something, and that will save this town. I refer to that as a fountain approach, the university as fountain, kind of driving out innovation and ideas and people. I think a second approach is one where we step back and we think about, well, why was the university in this position in the first place to be called upon? And it's because universities in our cities today have just a lot of respect. People believe in their mission. They feel good towards universities. A university is an organization, a community that has a high amount of status and a high amount of trust. And that makes it a place, I think, where people can get together on sort of neutral territory and work together, and where some of the connections that we've been talking about that link up disconnected parts of a community can start to happen. And I call that a forum approach, meaning the university acts as a sort of forum for interaction and building social capital. In the end, I think the fountain approach, this idea that the university pushes out ideas and innovation, is certainly important, but maybe not actually as important as the forum approach. And I think personally the forum approach, this idea of using the university as a meeting ground, that we need to pay more attention to and try to understand better.
You seem to be making a case in your body of work for the value of facilitators or connectors in cities. You just mentioned that. And you've given the example of an institution, a university, playing the role of connector. It seems to me that it's a much needed position, but it's one that's sort of hard to identify and compensate. I mean, we don't have people who are designated connectors and get paid to be that for communities. So how do we find those connectors, and then how do we encourage them and reward them in a community? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, sure, a little bit. I mean, I think first, as far as finding them, again, we get back to this thing about when you just think about the world as this place where it's complicated and there are relationships flying all over the place. And when you kind of think about it in that very general sense, I think it's very difficult. But when you actually start to kind of sit down and take it apart and figure out, all right, well, what are the dimensions on which we need to start connecting people? Well, who are the key actors? Well, what are their actual connections? Once you start to boil it down that way and you simplify the world a little bit, you can put it on a piece of paper and you can actually see, okay, you know what? This is a group of people, or this is a person, or this is an institution, or this is an organization that's in a position to play this kind of role. And we've started to do this in lots of arenas. In this world of economic development, the university has certainly emerged as one of them. If we think about lower income communities and certainly the African American community, the church is an organization that is in that role for whatever reason. And we've begun to think through, well, how do we take advantage of the fact that this is a place where people are already interacting and that they trust? So I think identifying it is actually easier than sometimes we make it out to be, or these people. Rewarding them is maybe a different thing. I mean, there's certainly intrinsic value people get out of this. I think, you know, we can all think of our friends out there who just seem to, what they really enjoy doing is bringing together people, or maybe our grandmothers enjoy this, but there's an intrinsic value to it. But also, what ends up happening in any place like this, I'm a sociologist and I think about things like status and reputation. There are rewards that come from being visible, that come from being a person in a social structure that plays this kind of valuable role. And it's not only sort of intrinsically that we get, I'm happy to be respected, But at the same time, people or organizations or individuals or institutions that are in that role actually benefit a lot from the information that's flowing through them. So a university playing that role, for instance, is in a much better position to be in touch with ideas, with people, with, you know, new markets that will improve what it's doing, let's say, in its core mission, right? Certainly, I think this kind of forum role that I'm talking about is not its core mission, but in engaging in this role, they are putting themselves in a position to do much better research, which is ultimately the real goal of any university.
Sean, given the right social networks, the right knowledge networks, the right strategy, can every city be successful?
It's a difficult question because in the end, partly the answer is I'm not sure. Meaning, I don't think there's a magic bullet in terms of what these structures should look like. And more importantly, I think some places, for historical reasons, have a big leg up. And if we think about what's going on in the world as knowledge and capital and people flowing much freer than they did in the past, they're going to flow into places that have that historical leg up. That's somewhat pessimistic. For the places that don't have the legacy of a social structure that is going to help them move forward, I do think there are things they can do. I mean, essentially, I think the sooner you start acting, the better it's going to be. It's like getting into the real estate market. And if you start acting now to try to identify where those holes are and think creatively about how to fill them, I think what's really important, you might start seeing results right away, but much more importantly, the next time that crisis hits, and there always will be a crisis down the road, you're going to be in a much better position to respond to it and to move forward and start making those incremental steps.
Sean, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Sean Safford is Assistant Professor of Organizations and Strategy at the University of Chicago. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Saskia Sassen about global cities. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Saskia Sassen is the Ralph Lewis Professor of Sociology at the University of Chicago and Centennial Visiting Professor at the London School of Economics. Her books have been translated into 13 languages. They include The Global City, New York, London, Tokyo, and Global Networks, Linked Cities. Saskia, you are an expert on globalization and its impact on cities. First, describe this concept of globalization. What's happening?
Well, there are two halves to globalization. One half is familiar, and I would say is the dominant image, and that is about geographic dispersal and simultaneous integrated communication systems. You can locate anywhere as a firm, and you can be in direct contact and in 1 second simultaneous time communication. But I argue that that's only half of the story, though it has gotten most of the attention. The other half is that the more firms disperse geographically and locate their operations, whether this is affiliates, factories, service outlets, offices across the world, the more their central management functions become very, very complicated, very specialized. You are dealing with 32 countries, each with its own accounting system, each with its own legal system, each with its own business culture, etc., etc. So central management functions become incredibly complicated. It is in this complexity that spatial agglomeration, ironically, continues to provide firms with enormous utilities. Why? Because no firm, no professional, no matter how expert, no matter how global, has a full understanding of the picture out there. So what these firms are looking at is a puzzle of which they only have a few parts. The only way, and it really is quite an irony, actually, given that this is capitalism and not central planning, but the only way they can get a fuller picture is by collectivizing the effort of producing the knowledge capital or the knowledge they need. And that means that cities, especially complex cities, which have a multiplicity of state-of-the-art corporate services, have the infrastructure that you need, the people and firm and diversity infrastructure in terms of specialized types of knowledge that you need to produce a kind of knowledge capital that is actually bigger than the sum of its parts. And that is where the global city function sort of enters into the picture. So it really is the other half. And the hypothesis that I sort of launched is, in fact, the more globalized and the more digitized a firm's operations are, and digitization here means speed, velocity of transactions, the more they need a strong insertion at the level of management functions in a network of cities that is now about 40 global cities in the world.
And when you think about those 40 global cities, which U.S. cities would qualify as global cities?
Well, in the U.S., as in every other country probably, but especially in the U.S. because it's such a large country with several major cities, there are two major global cities. And one is New York, which has been that for a long time. And the other one is Chicago, which actually just enters this position of strength in the 90s. Boston is significant, San Francisco is significant, LA is significant, Miami is significant. But what these others beyond Chicago and New York have is a very specialized set of connections and functions in the global economic system, whereas Chicago and New York, especially New York, they're very broad. They have a lot of different functions that cover a broad spectrum of sectors. LA, for instance, it's really global entertainment industry. San Francisco, it's the Silicon Valley connection, it's new media, it's a certain kind of banking. Boston, it's asset management, basically. Miami is the place where firms, whether they are from South Korea, from Italy, from France, from Germany, have set up their regional headquarters for Latin America. So the other ones are enormously specialized functions. It's a narrow spectrum. Whereas New York and Chicago are enormously complex capabilities. I like to think of the global city function as a kind of capability. It's a networked capability, and in that sense also very urban, since it has its locational sort of side to it, which it's a capability for managing, servicing, designing, implementing, debugging the global operations of markets and firms.
Is there a way to measure the nature of a global city in objective terms, or is this simply an observation that you make?
Well, no, absolutely. You can measure it, and you can really go digging. I always say I'm a digger. You can really go digging and find out at a high level of specialization what are the capabilities that these cities have. Now, it's also an image. You know, there are all kinds of organizations that now call themselves globalcity.com. I keep discovering them. They always politely ask me to write something in their whatever publication, very fancy, glossy often. And sort of it's also an image that is used by, say, the world music circuit. It's an image that is used by those who are interested in diasporic politics. So it covers the spectrum from naughty neoliberal actors, you know what I mean? To sort of very identity politics and the other circuits, the people global circuits that we see appear through globalization. So, you know, it has that power also to be an image, often misused and sometimes beautifully used in ways that I hadn't even thought about. And, you know, I mean, I am not into the copywriting business, but if I had copyrighted or trademarked, I would have made quite a bit of money, actually. I keep discovering. Or cities, you know, urban governments that like to say that they are a global city. I mean, it's just incredible. And the title of the book is actually, many people know the book exists. They haven't read it, mind you. It's a real brick to read. It's a huge, boring book. I did all that detail measuring that you asked for. And but people know, they may know that the book exists, you know, but they don't necessarily know my name. So it's very funny. I sort of like that, you know, that the book has more presence in a whole variety of circuits. I'm not complaining, by the way, you know, than my name. So it stands on its own legs. And that means that it enters the public domain, the image, and it gets used in many different ways.
If you had only trademarked the word world class, world class in global city, you would have done really well. You make an interesting distinction between headquarters cities and producer cities or global cities. Tell me about those distinctions. And why headquarters are less important in your mind.
to mark the global city. Right, headquarters are very important. But let me start with the first observation, which is that there is a very strong tendency for people who want the short cut to understanding whether a city is or is not a global city is to count headquarters. So the more big global firm headquarters you have, the more likely you are to be global. And if you don't have that, my God, you can't possibly be global. Now, there is some truth to that. You know, it's not totally far-fetched. 20 years ago, in fact, it was a much better measure or indicator than the always already incomplete measure and incomplete sort of representation. But it was a better measure than it is today. I would say as of the 90s, as more and more firms go global, let's remember that we have over 175,000 multinational corporations today in the world, and we have a proliferation of enormously specialized global markets. If you look at finance, for instance, there are many, many financial markets, and one of the things that I do is to sort of locate the specialized circuits on which a city is located within finance. Chicago is on different circuits than New York. There is some overlap. There's a lot of overlap. That's the first half of the story, you know, competition. The other half is the specificity. But coming back to your question, in the 1990s, you have this explosion in the number of countries, cities that get connected to the global economy. The level of complexity of firms' operations, those and market operations that operate globally, was such that increasingly these headquarters began to outsource their management functions to specialized corporate service firms. So you bought some specialized, say, accounting information on accounting in Mongolia, or a piece of legal advice on how to handle Kyrgyzstan or whatever, where you did not want to hire full in-house staff within your corporation. When you were basically operating in a national setting or perhaps in some European countries and a couple of Latin American countries, you could sort of hire full-time in-house corporate staff to handle. The level of specialization was much lower, etc., etc. But what we have seen is a growing tendency to outsource high-level corporate functions. I use on purpose the language of outsourcing, though it is sort of a different kind of outsourcing, because we're talking about the most complex and specialized management functions, planning, you know, finance, etc. Now, what that means is that the more a corporate headquarter of a large firm, the term headquarter is confusing here because financial services firms also have headquarters, of course. But, you know, the large, say, industrial corporations that dominate a bit the global economy outside finance, the more those corporations outsource their management functions, I argue, the more they are free to locate anywhere. They can go to Utah, but what they keep needing is access to a complex networked capability. And it's a network of specialized financial services, legal, accounting, etc., advertising, communication, PR, all of these kinds of things. So when I arrived to Chicago, for instance, in 1998, from Columbia University, I went to the University of Chicago, everybody was in despair in Chicago because a lot of the big corporate firms that were still in Chicago were leaving. They were being merged into new firms, but it was a departure from Chicago. So the first thing I did as a little research project, I said, well, you know what? According to my thesis, the more these firms leave, the more the specialized service sector in Chicago will be busy because those firms will need even more to outsource top-level corporate functions, not all of them, but, you know, a lot of them, to specialized service firms that are located in this networked sector where there are multiple different service firms that together begin to fill in the puzzle that I talked about at the beginning. And so, you know, you can get a lot of this data, and it actually was indeed the case, that the total revenues, the total amount of business these specialized service firms were doing in Chicago rose. And it rose throughout the late 90s into the 2000s. That partly explains this enormous prosperity that you see enacted through a glamorized downtown in Chicago. More fancy restaurants, more fancy central, you know, Chicago apartments, more buying of fancy housing inside the city, etc., etc. So it sort of proved my thesis. So that means that by just looking at headquarters, you are really missing what is actually the strategic capability that a global city delivers, which is this networked sector that can produce critical pieces of the puzzle, critical pieces that will vary for different types of firms. And it's networked base. In other words, many, many different specialized firms that all have global operations and all bring in little pieces of understanding to this broader puzzle that marks the global city. Now, a city like New York has lost vast numbers of headquarters. It is still the premier global city, even after September 2001. In the U.S., Chicago, which lost really a lot of its big headquarters, is much more significant as a global city now than it was 20 years ago. So it's another meaning of the whole notion of the networked economy.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Saskia Sassen. She's the Ralph Lewis Professor of Sociology at the University of Chicago and Centennial Visiting Professor at the London School of Economics. When I ask you about global cities in the U.S., you mention only six. Two that are global, four that are specialized.
Yeah.
Can other cities develop this capability, this networked set of producers that right. become the outsourced resource for corporations?
Well, you know, I didn't give you the full count because Minneapolis is critical for a certain kind of economic sector. It has several major global corporations. But the significance of Minneapolis is really centered on a few huge firms. So in that sense, it is more about those firms and a real global city, but it has a strong international insertion through these major industrial corporations. Atlanta has not only CNN, but it has a whole bunch of others. So I would say Atlanta, perhaps more so than Minneapolis, should be on that list as well. What Atlanta doesn't have is it doesn't have the financial function that Boston has, you know, which is when you say finance, you are talking global. So again, I mean, Atlanta has CNN, which is pretty global, and it has a bunch of firms. But again, it's more specialized, I would say, than some of the other six that I mentioned. The question you ask, the answer is yes, in principle, yes. But there is a qualifier, there is a but. And the but is that when you look around the world, you see a certain kind of pattern. There is a tendency towards nodal, lumpy geographies in national terrain. A few cities rise with growing powers, increasingly centralizing capabilities. Continental-sized countries like the U.S., in principle, you might say, you know, it should have six super powerful global cities. In fact, it only has two that are really, really multifaceted. Canada. Montreal has actually lost to Toronto. It's now trying to recover. Canada used to have at least three, you know, Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal. What happens in the 1990s is that Toronto just takes over. Australia, Sydney, it used to, you know, it has several cities that 20, 30 years ago were in play. And then Melbourne began to lose to Sydney, and Sydney really emerges as the premier global city. So what this all suggests is that there is a geography to the global city function that really tends towards a massive concentration into very limited number of places, and increasingly in some countries, just one. It used to be in France that you had Paris, Lyon, Marseille, Bordeaux. Now you have Paris. Lyon is very prosperous, but it's considered a regional center. So Frankfurt used to be one of seven major financial centers in Germany. Frankfurt has now left the others behind. The others have become provincial. Frankfurt is the only one that is really a global financial center. Now, coming back then to your question for the United States, in principle, when there is sort of a mixed economic base in a city, high levels of specialization in a critical number of sectors, and a very distinct economic history to a place, so that you have accumulated as a city or as a region enormously specialized capabilities and functions and knowledge. That happened with Chicago, with agro-industrial. Then you're sort of set up to actually develop this capability for managing and servicing at a highly specialized level. But the geographic trends are really towards concentration in a limited number of places. Now, that does not mean that there isn't another trend which often gets overlooked, which is a growing demand for professional workers, a growth, in other words, of these kinds of specialized services, in just about every urban agglomeration. But that's a national trend. But it looks a bit the same, high-income gentrification, the reemergence of downtowns. And I always say that, in a way, what we're seeing are massive national trends towards this kind of demand for professional services, which at one end intersect with globalization and then produce sort of the global city function. But on most of the range are dealing with national firms, national markets, but still produce this new prosperous high-income professional city center.
So there's nothing wrong with being what you would call a provincial city or a city that right. is more focused on a nation rather than the world?
Absolutely not. I think most cities, and the biggest portion, when I look at input-output data for the tables for the American economy, you see this massive growth. Firms in all sectors, whether it's agricultural, mining, manufacturing, health, transport, they are all buying more specialized services. If you are a farmer, chances are you are buying more insurance, more finance, more accounting, more legal services, more PR services, consulting services than you did even 20 years ago and certainly 40 years ago. So this is for me the real meaning of a shift to a service economy. It's the growth of this intermediate economy. And that is one of the forms of growth, one of the sort of signs, if you want, of an advanced market economy, actually, is this growing intermediate economy. And it's an economy of professional services and also industrial services. You know, it's not just professional, but at the professional end, it does generate a lot of high-income jobs. And what I lost are a lot of the middle-level jobs in our economy. The middle-middle class is sort of thinning out. And so the growth of a professional class is a very dynamic factor in all kinds of places. And the notion that you have to be global to have that is simply incorrect.
Have you looked at the impact, Saskia, on the worker class, if you will, or
yes.
on people who are making moderate wages in low-pay service jobs?
Look, the statistics are out there at all levels. At the national level, we know that low-income jobs are growing fast as are high-income jobs. The share of national income that the top 20% of the U.S. workforce has increased sharply over the last 20 years, and the share that the lowest 20% and even 40% have, the share of total national income, has declined, not as sharply, mind you, as the top has increased. If you look at a city like New York, where the top 20% is the richest sector in the whole country, the official poverty rate in New York City is almost 30%. Nationwide, it just went up from 16% to 18%. In New York City, it is 30%. A very good share of those, half of that, are working poor. You know, we now have all understood that there is such a category as the working poor. They simply are not, they are working. They are not making enough money to go over the poverty rate, which is a scandal. And we have a very ungenerous poverty rate. I mean, you have to be a nutrition genius to feed your family healthily on what that poverty rate is. So we are not generous the way we count it. Now, in between, there is this sort of slightly impoverished middle class that is fighting. And there is a kind of fact that is allowing them to survive a little better than their children might, which is that they own their houses. Because they come out of an era where it was possible for them to actually buy their houses. Now, we know from the statistics that their sons and daughters may be less likely. So when you look at the statistics right now, never has the population of the United States had such a high share of home ownership. What is not sufficiently observed, because people or the journalists don't go digging into that, is the extent to which that high incidence of ownership is a function of homes bought really a while ago, many years ago. Yes, there is all kinds of people who are buying new homes, no doubt about that. Many more blacks own their homes nowadays than they have ever done. But still, there is a good 30%, I would say, of what was the middle class that is losing position, I would say, in the economic ladder. And I don't know how that will play out. You know, there are new sectors that may appear, but I would say that we have moved away from a situation, I'm persuaded of this, by the way, we have moved away from a situation where economic growth translated in the growth of a huge middle class. This was the story of the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. Now we are in a situation where economic growth, the more dynamic it is, the more it's going to generate this upper 20%, even 30% of very high income, very prosperous people, and then a middle class that is neither here nor there. And chances are so many low-wage jobs that we get the working class poor actually growing in numbers.
Saskia, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
It was my pleasure.
Saskia Sassen is the Ralph Lewis Professor of Sociology at the University of Chicago. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. City News commentator Walker Smith is concerned about the act of consumption and how it affects being a citizen in a free market economy.
Consumer spending accounts for the largest part of the American economy, and the continued strength of consumer spending has sustained the momentum of economic growth and expansion that economists feared would slump in the wake of the dot-com crash and 9/11. This has surprised many observers, and worries about how long it can last provide endless fodder for cable pundits. But there's more to this than just the accumulation impulse, because what we do reflects how we think of ourselves. We recognize that we play a social and economic role as consumers, and with pocketbooks in hand, that's what we do. We enjoy clever ads, and we'd like to keep up with the latest products and styles. We can converse in marketing vernacular, and we know all about focus groups and advertising storyboards. Shopping is entertainment. Buying can be a thrill. The creature comforts of the consumer marketplace are emotionally satisfying, too. We know that we are consumers, and as our actions make clear, it's an important way in which we think of ourselves. Contrast this to other sorts of roles and self-regard. Voting is far from universal, and immoderate tabloid sensationalism holds sway in contemporary political dialogue. Civic organizations continue to struggle with declining interest and involvement. Television viewing is America's number one leisure activity, a sedentary pastime not unrelated to our soaring rates of obesity. Church attendance at mainstream denominations is still declining, and evangelical trends notwithstanding, spirituality in America, not to be too cynical about it, is largely about scented candles, day spas, and self-help programs. If our actions are any indication, we think of ourselves more as consumers than as citizens. This is not to suggest that we don't value or esteem our country. It is only to observe that we are much more likely to engage in activities that involve being a consumer than those that involve being a citizen. We are consumers more than we are citizens. Now, perhaps the balance between being a citizen and being a consumer is always and unavoidably tilted toward being a consumer. After all, our free market system depends upon an active, engaged consumer base in order to generate the wealth and comforts that underpin the perceived legitimacy and overall stability of our society. So being a consumer may well be job one. But even so, today's balance is out of whack, and this imbalance is not without consequence. Consuming is about our preferences. Citizenship is about our obligations. As consumers, what we know, learn, and do is dictated only by what we like. But as citizens, what we know, learn, and do is affected by what we owe. Self-interest and egotism fuel the former. Empathy and sacrifice underpin the latter. We must not lose a sense of ourselves as citizens if we are to sustain the compassion, civility, and charity that keeps life from devolving into a free-for-all. We won't get that push from marketers. We can only give it to ourselves. Not that we should spend less, It's just that we should do more. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, sign up for podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music provided by Christopher Reyes. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.